Good morning. Now, if you've tuned into Playback to get the juicy bits of all the political leaders' interviews over the week, would-be Taoiseach coming a cropper, TDs floundering and flustered, high-level spats littered with unparliamentary language, well, I'm afraid you need to go elsewhere. And here's why. Take it away, Ray D'Arcy.
There are rules set down, you know, in RTE to make sure we're fair and unbiased and balanced, and there are people with stopwatches. There are people with stopwatches when it comes to a debate to make sure that, you know, if one person gets 4 minutes, that the other party gets 4 minutes and the other party gets 4 minutes. And over the course of the whole campaign, it's evened out, which is great. And rules are rules, and I'm happy to abide by rules. But you know, you can trip up along the way, can't you? You can trip up along the way. And if, for example, I mentioned a candidate by accident, I'm obliged then to mention all the other candidates in that constituency. And what if I don't have the list to hand? That it just, you know, it was in a conversation, I mentioned the person. So I've come up with a genius idea. I've got Fiona Donlan, who works on the team and used to work on Clare FM. Very good speaking voice. I've got her to record all the candidates for all the constituencies. And I have them there in front of me. So, you know, break glass in case of emergency. So if some name slips out by accident, I have it there immediately. Say, for example, I said, wait till I see who's there now. Say I said Micheál Martin, then...
Candidates also running in Cork South Central: Lorna Beau, Green Party; Jerry Boshmer, Fine Gael; Simon Coveney, Fine Gael; Anna Daly, Aintu; Paddy Dineen, Independent; John Donoghue, Independent; Ciara Kennedy, Labour; Michael McGrath, Fianna Fáil; Bobby Murray Walsh, Solidarity, People Before Profit; William O'Brien, Independent; Patricia O'Dwyer, Social Democrats; Sean O'Leary, Independent; Donoghue O'Leary, Sinn Féin.
I'm told you can't put a hip-hop beat behind it. It's cumbersome, I'll agree with you. But rules is rules. Rules is rules. And if I was to say, I loved Leo's suit, for example.
Candidates also running in Dublin West: Joan Burton, Labour; Peter Casey, Independent; Jack Chambers, Fianna Fáil; Ruth Coppinger, Solidarity, People Before Profit; Emma Curry, Fine Gael; Paul Donnelly, Sinn Féin; Edward McManus, Aintu; Roderick O'Gorman, Green Party; Sean O'Leary, Independent; Stephen O'Loughlin, Independent; Angus O'Mealon, Social Democrats.
Oh, yeah. We're lucky it only comes around every 4 or 5 years.
And there you have it, fair and balanced, but hardly, I think you'll agree, Playback listeners, riveting radio. Which doesn't mean you won't hear anything about the election, because on the same programme, Ray spoke to Alan Kinsella about his collection of election memorabilia. Have a listen to this bag of tricks he's amassed.
50,000 leaflets, 500 posters, and then there's the badges, stickers, other things that are given out at election time. Simon Harris gave out wet wipes the last time.
Yeah.
Of a harmonica, packets of seeds, condoms.
Who gave out the condoms? Can you remember?
Labour, Sinn Féin. Right. There's all sorts of gimmicks, shopping bags, coats, jumpers, everything.
I love the way Ray picked up on the condoms there. Straight in he was. But there appears to be no lengths political parties won't go to get your attention.
The Irish Socialist Network in 2007. Had the back of their leaflet as a pizza menu. The same, the Young Progressive Democrats produced a pizza menu as well.
Right. And so they're having a go at all the other parties because they
But,
So this is Progressive Democrats. So these are the various pizzas, and you can match up various political parties with these at home. It's a fun game. Fun game. Cheese and Sleaze. Who would that be with? Then there's Colombian Hot and Spicy, Socialist and Mushroom. Limited edition, old style slice, vegetarian bite, and roaring red pizza.
Ah, yes, but who'd be the pineapple topping? That's the real question. But when it came to posters, well, this texter had a memory to share.
We made great use of an election poster during the unusual heavy snowfall back in 2010. We had no toboggans, etc., but we hit quite a speed whizzing down the very snowy hill of Tara, sitting on Enda's face.
And it must be said, in the interests of balance, I'm sure all the party leaders' faces are equally slippy. However, we can give you some election-y food for thought, general thoughts, mind you, with no political hue in mind. On the News at One, economics professor at the University of Limerick, Stephen Kinsella, spoke to Áine Lawler about his concerns about a return to giveaway or auction politics.
It certainly feels that way, or at least it's beginning to feel that way. I think it's important to acknowledge that we haven't actually seen the detail of any of these policies from any of the parties. So we're still very much in the dark as regards the actual nuts and bolts of the policies they propose. So that's a very important point. The other kind of important thing is it's starting to feel like a bidding war for the public's affections. And I would hope and pray that the Irish public know that being bought off with their own money is not a great way to start.
I want you to put it to him that the next government is estimated to have about 11 billion at their disposal. So maybe this giveaway can be paid for.
It's based on the assumption of relatively stable growth. And we know one thing for sure in this country, that we typically don't have stable growth. We grow very fast or we don't grow at all. And so what I really like to see from the various parties is, what's your plan if Brexit doesn't work out the way we want it to? What's your plan if corporation tax revenues drop suddenly? What's your plan if corporation taxes go up suddenly, as they have been for the last while? So, let's say the clauses are different measures. How are you going to cut it? And that would very much boost credibility, in my view. Right now, simply saying we will spend X, Y, and Z, it's just not good enough.
Ooh, well, maybe so, but Áine finished up with this little trip down memory lane.
You are advocating prudence and cautioning against auction politics, but you're probably too young to remember Charlie Haughey's view of economists, but it certainly wasn't that if you took their advice, you'd win elections.
That is true, but the day after the election, all this has to be paid for. And that's the one thing economists continually say. You know, we've gone broke as a country three times in the last 90 years. And the way to stop ourselves going broke again is to make sure that the money we have coming in roughly matches the money we have going out. And the only way to do that is to maintain fiscal prudence and then get the reallocation of the taxes in a much more effective way. And I think that's where the debate needs to be had.
Professor Stephen Kinsella is heard on Thursday's News at One. And the next day, Áine Lawler spoke to Dr. Adrian Kavanagh from the School of Geography in Maynooth. And she asked him about an Irish perennial, the weather.
Talk to us about the cold snap that's on the way and the impact that might have on campaigning for everybody out there.
So obviously, if there's a cold snap, that's going to restrict the campaigning. Probably the out-and-out nightmare for candidates probably is if the cold snap is associated with a storm, which means a lot of the posters you put up a few days ago may be scattered to the four elements. Weather, of course, when it comes to February the 8th, could also have an impact in terms of turnout in the day, because as we saw in 2002, if weather is bad on election day, that's going to have an impact on the number of people turning out to vote. So all campaigning efforts could come to naught as a result.
It all depends on the weather. Spare a thought for all those canvassers in their thermals this weekend.
Áine Lawler and Dr. Adrian Kavanagh on the News at One yesterday. And staying with the political realm, pensions have become a hot potato as controversy around the increased retirement age rages. On Wednesday, Charlie Weston and Philip Ryan of the Irish Independent came in to talk to Sean O'Rourke about the pensions our politicians receive.
Yeah, an ordinary teacher, they accumulate pension benefits at a rate of about 1/80th of salary a year. A TD, they accumulate pension benefits at a rate of about 1/40th of a year, so twice as good. You take a minister, they accumulate pension benefits at about 1/20th of a year. So the minister's pension is four times better than the teacher's. You know, and, you know,
except
a precarious
for the teacher,
career.
The teacher, yeah, exactly. On that point, I mean, the TD, our minister, goes before the employer every 4 to 5 yeah. years, and they can be fired summarily at the ballot box.
Of course, they can, Sean. Yeah, and I'm making that point. Yeah, but you know, in the context of a situation where people are being told you're not getting your state pension until you're 66 and 67 next year, it's probably galling for a lot of people.
And just on that point as well, on the flip side is that TDs do make a contribution, obviously, for their pension as well. It's around 6% or more. They do pay into it. It's not like they're just giving it. So they are contributing to get the pension.
The Sean O'Rourke Show on Wednesday. One place where opinions did flow freely, though, was in the realm of fast food. The Takeaway Awards, for yes, there is such a thing, prompted stars of The Wireless, Ryan and Ray, to ponder their preferences. Ray spoke to Zoe from Sansab and Drumcondra, and they'd been awarded the best spice bag in Ireland.
It's breaded deep fried chicken with chips, and then there's spring onions, fresh
peppers, and our own spice mix.
And is there onion in there?
And there's onions
and spring onion. Oh yeah, there's onion and spring onion. Yeah. And there's no.
I'm going.
And it's dry. It's dry, which I like.
Yes.
Oh, that's very good.
Oh, it's lovely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Lovely kick at the end.
Everybody loves a spice bag.
Not strictly true, Zoe, because earlier that day...
Tried it, hated it, absolutely didn't like it at all. No, did nothing for me. Sweet and sour chicken balls, fried rice, the only answer. Don't give me spice bag. No, you can't.
Golly, so spice bag out the window. What does wine like?
Combine a packet of chips from Italian Chipper, loads of salt, loads of vinegar, brown bag in the car, you're not allowed to have it. Cheeky can of Coke on the side, still sweating with the cold from the fridge. You're starving. You don't even want a burger with it because it's too messy. But you want those. And then you just open that bag. Little puff of heaven in your face. And then the Coke. And like, that's a banquet, lads. That's a banquet.
And there you have it. Playback. All the big questions answered. Back after this. Welcome back. We've become all too familiar with the criminality intrinsic to the drug trade in this country, the murders and violence that terrorise families and communities. And it's our society's cocaine use that is fueling much of this. On Thursday, Sean O'Rourke spoke to Sandra McAleer, a family law solicitor based in Dublin, who talked about the prevalence of cocaine use in the cases she sees.
And it's not one day I go by that cocaine is not in one of my cases. It's either a situation where people have got, it's acceptable to have cocaine on the weekend. Like they work Monday to Friday, people go out, they don't have a few drinks anymore, they have cocaine, they get cocky, they think they're great. They're either, I had a case one time that your man didn't even realise the damage he did to his wife. She had two black eyes, she had a busted nose. And I asked him, did you do that? And he turned around, I can't remember. So that was quite recently. I had a situation where a 13-year-old, subject of a family law proceedings, was taking coke. That's not acceptable in any shape or form.
Yeah, and have you seen an increase or a significant increase in cocaine use in recent times?
Oh, Sean, huge, huge. Years ago, cocaine was a rich man's drug. It was all at the top level. Now it's from people working from unemployed all the way up. It's got to a situation where it's not an elite drug anymore. It's got for normal people, Joe Soaps, that work Monday to Friday and don't realise the damage they're doing on the weekends.
And Sean asked about the money involved.
What about the financial implications of this?
Oh, I can be here all day. Unfortunately, coke is not cheap, but people seem to find the money to get it. I have situations where men are due to pay maintenance, and one lad got up into the box and says, I have a coke problem. That justified him to spend 40,000 within 6-7 weeks.
Good.
I said he had to pay off. He had to pay off his drug debt or else he was going to be killed.
And
so
where,
he spent the 40,000 of his savings.
And I mean, so it was savings he had, and in a few short weeks, less than 2 months, he'd gone through 40 grand.
He left his wife and 6 children and he went on a mad drug-fueled situation. He works as a civil servant, normal person, had 42,000 savings, and when my client applied for maintenance, he got rid of it all. And he was actually very proud, and I have a drug problem. He thought that would justify him spending 40,000. I can go on. It just literally, people take the lump sums out, and they don't realise when they take 200 or 300 euros out the weekend, where it's going, and it's money hard earned, but very quickly go.
Family law solicitor Sandra McAleer with Sean on Thursday. Later that same day, Mary Wilson spoke to Galway-based Joe Tracy from the Addiction Counsellors of Ireland.
This is crossing every social class, if you like, is it?
A whole generation will be lost because of this. I have never witnessed an epidemic, and I have to use that word very carefully, of drug usage in small villages, large cities, towns, in every aspect. There is a criminal aspect to it. There is a money aspect to it. There is a violent aspect to it. It has delivered an untold tsunami across the country, and we're not addressing it. We have lost the edge on treatment settings. We have lost the ability to engage with it appropriately. We have not kept up with this epidemic, as I keep saying, that has befallen this country.
And you treat teenagers. You have like 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, and you know, Gareth talking about people in their 40s and 50s sitting in their cars, taking coke to get themselves ready for the day.
I have said this very carefully. There is an underclass of corporate people driving this, generating this, weddings, occasions, there's now a person procuring the drug. When you consider what we've heard last week in relation to the violence that has attached to this industry of dismembering people and dousing people, that is all drug-related. The stakes are so incredible. It's just it shows no sign of abating.
So, Joe, do you think, or are you seeing with the people who come to you, a sort of a connection to what we'll call maybe grotesque violence?
We have sold a lifestyle. It's attractive to young people that are on the margins. I sit in court from time to time and I watch very young people being criminalised because of their behaviour or their activity, or losing their ability to be professional in their careers because of a criminal offence. That's what I see on a daily basis. This is generational. A whole generation are tend to be damaged and hurt by this. I listened to the Sean O'Rourke interview this morning. Shocking, but true. That's exactly where it's at.
Drive Time on Thursday. Lifeline continued a conversation they started last week with women married to men who had then come out as gay. Men living lives of shame and secrecy in an Ireland that simply did not accept homosexuality, but whose devastated wives and partners had also suffered deep hurt and betrayal. The programme disguised the women's voices and changed the names of the callers. This is Josie, who phoned in on Monday. She'd been married with children, but once she and her husband divorced, she learned that he was gay, and in her mind, he was oblivious to the damage this had caused.
Well, the marriage was full of lies. And I could never pinpoint what the lies were about or what he was trying to hide. And I thought I'd gone through everything in my head as to what it could possibly be. Until it got to a point where I couldn't take the lies anymore, where I knew he was blatantly lying. And lying to my face, even when I presented the truth to him, and what he was saying wasn't, couldn't possibly be true, he still claimed that what he was telling me was true. And I couldn't go on with the marriage any longer. And as far as I was concerned, he was a liar. I didn't know what he was lying about. I knew I couldn't live with it any longer. I knew I deserved better than that. I knew our children deserved better than that. So when I found out that he was gay, I suppose it explained an awful lot. And sort of maybe some pieces fell into place. I can't say that I ever suspected, because I didn't. But I had exhausted, I thought, all avenues. Obviously, there was one avenue I hadn't considered. And so this was the reason. This was what all the seat was about.
And Josie had asked her husband when he knew he was gay.
And he said, all my life.
And why didn't he?
And that was so hurtful to me, because he lied the whole way through our marriage. And I thought, why couldn't he just tell me one more lie? You know, and say he only realised lately or whatever, you know. But, like, why couldn't he just tell me one more lie? Did he have to be so hurtful? And he was so blatant, you know. He said, look, I saw a kid getting beat up when I was younger because he was gay. And I thought, that's never going to happen to me. And I said, well, you stood in a church in front of our families and you married me. And he says, well, I knew there was no other way you'd marry me if I didn't go to the church. And I just felt used as a cover story for him, so that he could cover up who he really was. And I believe he continued to live a life of secrecy. And I felt, so when I found out, I felt used, I felt abandoned, I felt worthless.
Josie on Monday's Liveline. On Wednesday, Sophie rang in. She'd been married for 10 years and her husband had died by suicide. And after his death, a man came to the door asking to keep his ashes.
Couple of weeks after his funeral, a friend of his contacted me looking for his ashes. It was then I realised that there was a relationship going on with him.
With this man, this other man.
And Sophie's marriage, and indeed their entire relationship, had been one devoid of sex.
And you say you had no sexual relationship in the marriage.
No, I always took it that it was just set in his old ways, and he was waiting until he got married, and it would all change when we got married, but it didn't. It never changed.
And am I right in assuming you've no children by a previous or subsequent relationship?
No, and now it's too late for me to have children. I'm just too old now to have children.
So that's another act of betrayal.
It is. I feel cheated by this. I really feel cheated by the whole lot. I know that he's taken his own life. I just feel it's a pity he couldn't have talked about it.
Sophie is heard on Wednesday's Live Line. The previous day, Grainne had phoned in. She'd been married for over 30 years, and 4 years ago, her husband told her he was gay.
And what was that like, the revelation?
It was a shock. Just in that moment, though, everything made sense.
Everything slotted into place, so to speak.
Yes, and that's when you start on the going back over conversations and scenarios, and that happens at 3-4 in the morning. Outrageous.
And again, her husband had always known he was gay.
He knew he was gay from the time he was a teenager. Mm. He knew that marriage and that side of life wasn't for him. Mm. I did feel that he was distant and
distant.
Aloof.
Okay.
And any time I questioned it, it was put down to pressures of work. Mm. You know, and he's happy, there's nothing wrong. Mm. So you start to think it's yourself. And that you're imagining things, and so you take on what he can't. Do you understand what I'm saying? That you kind of feel that you're lacking in some way, or that you want more than you deserve, or that there should be more than you're actually getting. You're not happy with your lot.
So I think Josie said she thought there was something wrong with her.
Yes, you can think that, yes.
And Joe asked Grainne how she viewed their life together now.
You're questioning everything. You're looking back at all the scenarios, all the conversations, and you look on it with a different light now. Oh, that's why he did this. That's why. And there's one thing about suppressing it, but if you're only suppressing it to the public and you're actually engaging in a double life, that's completely different.
John was also on the line. He'd been married for 15 years and then come out to his partner, and he offered this perspective.
Being in the closet, for the want of a better word, is a really dark place to be, and nobody should be there, you know.
And what was it? What was it like for you living in that scenario?
Well, you know, when you suppress part of who you are, you know, it may seem, you know, to the outside world they wouldn't even notice. It's within yourself, isn't it? You know, but it becomes your body becomes like a pressure cooker, you know.
Okay.
And you suppress it, and the pressure builds up over time, and it just comes to a point in life where you just can't take anymore, you know, this whatever it is, part of what we are, you know.
And both Grainne and John hoped that maybe we might be the last generation to have to experience this particular kind of pain and shame.
This won't be happening in 10, 15, 20 years down the road, because the kids today don't have to hide who they are.
Yeah, good
You're
point.
You're talking about men here who were brought up in the
70s,
80s, 90s. You know,
I sincerely hope not.
If our kids do go on to make mistakes, we don't. We failed as a society. We failed them kids.
I agree.
You know, so what we need to do is now, as is happening now in the schools, they're bringing in, you know, sex education. They're teaching kids, you know, there's so many different options out there, or that you won't be judged or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
John and Grainne as heard on Liveline. The World Health Organization has stopped just short of declaring the new strain of the coronavirus a global emergency. However, cities in China are being sealed off, with 41 million people hit by a transport ban. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, Gavin Jennings spoke to Kildare man Ben Kavanagh, who is living in Wuhan, the city of 11 million people at the centre of this virus.
Well, right now I'm just sitting in my apartment, and there's no chance of me going outside anytime soon, because everyone's saying not to leave at any point at all.
And are there people out on the streets?
usually the street I can see from my apartment would be quite busy, but I live near a dual carriageway that I can see, and that it's almost like a ghost town.
Are people allowed out, or are they staying in because they're worried?
You are allowed out, but there's been so many rumours and things that are happening that it's just better not to. Recently, we've been told that it can transmit through eyes now. So people have been wearing masks to keep the infection at bay, but now we're being told to wear eye protection as well, because that's another way we can be infected. I believe that's how the people in the hospital have been transmitting it.
When was the last time you went out?
Maybe 2-3 days ago.
Are you worried?
The only thing that's changed for me for the worry, everyone, nothing's really changed for the virus, but everyone's just taking it a lot more seriously. So I wasn't worried 4 or 5 days ago when it was the same situation. But now that everyone's taking it more seriously, it does play on your mind a bit.
If you have to go out tomorrow to get some food, what precautions are you going to take?
Well, I'll have a surgical mask and I'll actually probably wear swimming goggles just to be safe.
And on Friday, a man in Belfast was being tested for the virus. Gavin spoke to Dr. Cudahy, director of the HSE's Health Protection Surveillance Centre.
Dr. Cudahy, there's no direct flights between Belfast and Wuhan province, but there's a man being in isolation, being treated for symptoms and being tested. What happens if that case turns out to be positive?
The European Communicable Disease Control Centre, as I mentioned, has done a risk assessment and considered that the likelihood of cases in European countries is moderate. Where there are no direct flights is obviously less than where there are. But it's likely that patients will present who are concerned and who have some respiratory symptoms. We're still in flu season, and they will be assessed, as we've seen in various countries, including here in Ireland, but using those algorithms and the case definition and the guidelines that we have available across the health system, these situations can be de-escalated quite quickly, as we've seen.
Dr. Cudahy of the HSE has heard on Morning Ireland yesterday. On the musical map of Ireland on Sunday evening, Cathal Funge explored how musicians use field recordings and everyday sounds in their music. This is Thahi.
I came across a interview that somebody made with my grandmother. Like a 2-hour long interview.
Just going to dance with it and there'd be no more about it. But sure, didn't we think we were got under the Haley Cabot Charles?
Like all this weird stuff in it.
I think we were nearly 15 years before we knew where we were got.
There's one little part in it towards the end where she's talking about when you were younger and how when you were going to be matched up with somebody, people would be like cleaning the houses and stuff. And then she starts like going on this angle, which is basically kind of going like, oh yeah, sure, when we were there, like, you know, my older sister was getting like set up with a lad from the family and stuff, and we'd go clean the house and everything. And then it starts cutting in, then suddenly just kind of talking about how people met people. And then she was like, yeah, but sure, when I was my age, like I didn't even bother. It's like, I met my husband down in Kilfenora. And then like you can hear her getting a little bit more emotional about the whole thing, and it kind of hits on her. You can hear her voice crack. And then she has this, and I fell in love with him kind of thing. And I was like, that is golden.
And my father would come, and my uncle would come, and he'd say, Mary, this man over in Carn has a big farm of land. You'll have to go over and meet. So no, I didn't. I met my future husband down in Kilfenora, and I fell in love with him.
Oh, that twinkle in the eye. That was Dahi and his granny, as heard on the musical map of Ireland. A really beautifully made programme. Well worth a listen. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, if it wasn't such an institution on the, well, institutional calendar, you'd be forgiven for thinking the World Economic Forum in the Swiss town of Davos is something dreamt up by the Bond scriptwriting team. Black helicopters landing on snow-capped mountaintops, titans of industry in leather-backed chairs, swirling whiskey while plotting world domination, evil eye patch optional, or, as Bonner described it, fat cats in the snow. On Wednesday's Drive Time, Mary Wilson spoke to Ryan Heath, senior editor with Politico, who had slept out with protesters in freezing conditions.
You were there in the cold last night, and very, very cold it must have been. How many of the multimillionaires and billionaires and industrialists came to talk to the protesters?
That was just me. Sorry to report that. We have a situation here where there's more than 100 billionaires that are circling or participating in the conference. And the reason I chose to do that is I thought, I've seen all of the highs of Davos. You can get all the caviar and all the celebrities you want here. And I've been doing that for 8 years. But with so many messages and so much concern around extreme weather, extreme inequality, and other extremes in our society, I thought it's time to experience those extremes. And I have to say, a lot of people were scared to join that. They didn't like the idea of being in minus 17 degrees. They prefer to talk about these issues rather than experience those realities.
Sorry, how many billionaires?
More than 100 billionaires.
Because mere millionaires, just so 90s. Well, a man who, as you might suspect, did not throw out the bedroll in the snow was President Donald Trump. However, he did have an alliterative promise to save the planet.
We're committed to conserving the majesty of God's creation and the natural beauty of our world. Today, I'm pleased to announce the United States will join 1 Trillion Trees Initiative, being launched here at the World Economic Forum. 1 Trillion Trees. This is not a time for pessimism. This is a time for optimism. Fear and doubt is not a good thought process, because this is a time for tremendous hope and joy and optimism and action. But to embrace the possibilities of tomorrow, we must reject the perennial prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse.
Mary Wilson, however, struck a somewhat skeptical note.
1 trillion trees doesn't cut it.
Absolutely not. I think people, you saw from that scattered applause, welcome the commitment to 1 trillion trees. But no one's fooled. Donald Trump doesn't believe in any kind of serious systematic government action on climate change. That's why he's decided to withdraw the US from the Paris Climate Agreement. And while that doesn't mean that anyone here can take the moral high ground, because there is a lot of greenwashing, there is a lot of good green talk, but not always green follow through. At the end of the day, there is a pretty strong consensus emerging here that we haven't been doing enough, and that it's going to require, if it's on everybody's part, fairly quickly to turn that around. And Donald Trump didn't come with any message to suggest he was really going to be joining that train today.
Ryan Heath from Davos, as heard on Drive Time. And staying with the US president, writer Armando Iannucci spoke to Ryan Tuberty on Thursday. He's just written and directed an adaptation of David Copperfield by Dickens, but he's also the satirical hand behind programmes like The Thick of It and Veep. So Ryan just couldn't resist asking him this.
That expression, you couldn't make it up. Has that expression ever been more true? I mean, Boris Johnson is your prime minister. Just felt the need to remind you. And a very
We're in a kind of living satire, isn't it? It's like the entertainers and comedians have become politicians.
Yes, in Ukraine and in America.
Yes, yes. I mean, Donald Trump is a TV entertainer interested in ratings. That's what he's interested in.
But not a fool.
No, he knows how to press all the right buttons. You know, he knows how people work and how they think. So he knows he's a salesman. That's what he is. And he's a very good one at selling himself. I think you make the mistake of thinking he's just an idiot and can be easily fooled. He can't.
And Armando spoke about the difficulty in doing satire in such a political climate.
It's the reason I'm not doing stuff like The Thick of It now is because actually, first, politics is changing every day. You know, it's every day is like more bizarre than the day before. So if you were to try and shoot something that then takes 6 months to make, and by the time it goes out, it would be out of date. But also, it sort of relies on there being a set of rules that people, if they break them, you show how they break them. But if there are no longer any rules, you can't show them being broken. You know, if Donald Trump says, literally, I can go and shoot a man in the face in the middle of Manhattan and still get elected, then, you know, we've already gone through the looking glass, really. There's nowhere else to go.
Armando Iannucci with Ryan. But spare a thought for the Donald. What between the impeachment and losing a staring contest to Greta Thunberg, he then had the Russians blaming him for the mild winter weather. Paranoid, or just not paranoid enough? Here's Anton Savage getting more than he's bargained for with Dave Fanning on Sunday.
They are saying that the US has used a climate weapon to warm up Russia. And the man, Alexei Zhuravlyov, has said that if Russia's permafrost melts now, it will be a disaster. The Americans know this and they're testing this weapon to melt their permafrost.
Now, are you saying this because isn't that really weird? Isn't this guy mad?
I'm saying it on the isn't this guy mad?
No, that's what? True. Well, it is. Oh, that's true. The environmental modification techniques. Honestly, what? Yeah, they made clouds on the Ho Chi Minh Trail between 67 and 68 to make it go 30 times wetter. The American army. Seriously. I swear to God. Cloud,
now, hang on.
Cloud seeding, it's called.
No, I know about cloud seeding.
Project Popeye. So I mean, I have to watch these documentaries.
I'm never sure with you if you're having an episode or if this is a real thing.
Definitely not.
They
no.
seeded the clouds over the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Check
make
out your nanotechnology and you'll see it all. Honestly, yeah, artificial weather, it's a thing. And in fact, not just that. Like the military uses it in that. It's the US and Russia. They develop capabilities basically to manipulate the weather, and it's Russia and US. So your man might be wrong. It could be his own government.
Have you been spending time on the internet? Where did you get this from, Dave? I want sources.
I just know these things. If you watch silly documentaries.
Anton Savage getting a learning from Dave Fanning. Sarah Canning is the partner of Lyra McKee, who was shot at a riot in Derry in April of last year. She spoke to Ray Darcy on Monday and he asked her about the apology issued by the new IRA for Lyra's murder.
Their apology means nothing. How can you apologise for something like that? You can apologise for running over somebody's foot. You can apologise for dropping a glass, but you can't say, oh, we're very sorry that we murdered a person you love. We'll try better next time. We'll try not to murder any innocent civilians. We'll aim for, policemen and women doing their job.
And Ray asked her how she was living with her grief, particularly in light of the introduction of same-sex marriage in Northern Ireland.
It was amazing to see it come after so many people have fought for so long. It's a beautiful thing. You have to look at the positives of things that come out in Northern Ireland, and that for me is a really big positive.
Hmm. How are you? Because not just losing a loved one, but losing a loved one in the way you did lose Lyra and been in such close proximity to the whole thing. Are you minding yourself?
I'm trying my best. It's not always easy. It's been a rough, over Christmas was pretty horrible. For a long time there, I was kind of running on adrenaline because there was always something. There was, something coming up. There was, an award or she was being honoured by something. And it was amazing to go along to see people kind of remembering Lyra and the things that she did and how amazing she was. And I think I ran on adrenaline for so long. And then kind of in October time, I was like, right, there's nothing now for a while. I'm going to take a long break. And then I know that the anniversary will get everything up and running again and then I'll be back under the coal face. And as soon as I took a break, everything kind of came crashing down. So I've had a few health issues and stuff like that, but right. I'm hopefully out the other side of it.
Sarah Canning, the partner of the late Lyra McKee, speaking to Ray Darcy. On Tuesday, Terry Gilliam spoke to Sean Roxon Arena about finally, and I do mean finally, getting to make his film, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
It really is one of those ones, Terry, that's been going on for a long time.
Yes, it has, and now it's finished. It's one of those, I don't know why I was born with a head that thought it could break its way through brick walls. But that's what I seem to have been doing for all this time. And it becomes kind of obsessional after a point. I am going to do this. I am going to finish this thing. And I was determined, I think, to beat Orson Welles because he never finished his version of Don Quixote. I had to be able to do one thing better than Orson Welles.
Well, the problem was primarily one of funding, but even then, the gods just didn't seem to be for him.
And in 2000, it was very close to actually happening.
Well, yes, that was already 11 years into 30 years. And I got Johnny Depp, I had Jean Rochefort, brilliant French actor, and off we went to Spain and we had a wonderful time for one, or was it 2 days, maybe three. By the fourth day, we were in major trouble. NATO was filling the sky with fighter bombers that were all preparing to fly off to Kosovo or Serbia. And Then we had a flash flood that wiped our sets out. Our equipment was completely mud-drenched. And then Jean Rochefort developed a disease and could not sit on his horse and had to be helicoptered off out to Paris. And that was the end of 5 days. That was it.
Oh, that is harsh. But in a strange way, it might have been a case of art imitating life.
Don Quixote, in some ways, that character, he is a man who refuses to accept reasonableness or rationality, possibly.
Quixote, in the original book, is wonderful because he becomes infected by reading books on chivalry, knighthood, nobility, maidens in distress, and he starts believing that. And so he's very noble, a man. His view of what the world is or should be is very noble and heroic. And he goes into the world believing that, and he just confuses what the world is. And reality, of course, always defeats him. And his great strength is he keeps getting up from the most appalling defeats. I mean, it's like he sees an army fighting and he's going to get involved in the army and do the right thing. The army turns out to be a flock of sheep, and so he's beaten up by the shepherds, and he drags himself up afterwards and goes on to his next quest, which is usually as mad as that. You know, misperceiving a windmill as a giant with arms 6 miles long, and he's there to destroy giants, and of course he gets whacked on the head, thrown off his horse, smashed to the ground, and then he's back up again. It's quite extraordinary. It's the myth of Sisyphus on a different level.
But a good lesson for life, possibly. A good lesson for a life in the art. A good lesson for life in anything, in fact.
I think so. I think it's really important to persevere. First of all, to believe in something. To believe in something that's worth believing in. And then trying to live a life accordingly. And not whinging and moaning and whining when it doesn't work. I mean, I get angry with all my failures along the years, and I get angry when I'm shooting the film because we don't have enough time to do that, or we've run out of money to do that. And yet I've found over the years that a certain adrenaline builds up inside me during moments like that, and out of that comes a solution to the problem that's more interesting than probably what I originally intended.
Terry Gilliam with Sean Rocks on Arena. Well, we're almost at a finish here on Playback, and on Wednesday the death was announced of fellow Python Terry Jones. So let's finish up with a bit of this.
Some things in life are bad, they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And
always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death.
That is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
For you draw